Hey everybody, welcome back. Today we're talking Lancia or Lancia. Lancia?
Or Lancia.
So many times I forget how to say it. It's not Lancia though, I know that.
Lancia.
Lancia. Lancia. Lancia. We're about to launch into this podcast.
Podcast. Yeah.
You just okay. Talk about like
let's get
ponds.
Scummy.
Yeah, we'll workshop that. But in the meantime, here is the story of one of the coolest and most heartbreaking, I think, car brands. It's Lancia. Lancia as a company has been around for more than 100 years. Their impact on automobile manufacturing and motorsport puts them in the upper echelon of car brands. From the first unibody chassis construction to the first V4 engine to their staggering amount of rally championship wins, Lancia deserves their seat at the table. Yet nowadays, they're largely forgotten and irrelevant. So, what the heck happened? Where did Lancia come from? And how do they make cars to rival Porsche and Ferrari? And how do we go from the Delta Integrale to the Ypsilon? This and much more coming up on Past Gas. And yeah, it's pronounced Lancia. Welcome to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joined as always by Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, happy to have me.
We're happy to have you too, Bart. And Joe Weber. What's up, dude?
Who do you think you are? I am.
Yeah. You've seen that, right, Nolan?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
the bowling guy?
Yeah.
That's
my
uncle, Pete Weber.
That's your uncle, Pete?
Yeah.
Nice.
Through marriage.
Yes, so it is not pronounced Lancia like I thought it was in sixth grade when I saw it in Gran Turismo. It is pronounced Lancia. We're going to get that
like
right
launch,
out of the way.
Like lawn chair if you're from Boston.
Yeah, lawn chair.
Lancia.
Lancia.
Or
grenade like, Lancia.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Or what we eat at noon.
Lancia?
Trying to mancha on my Lancia.
Nice. Okay. What do you guys know about this brand?
What's Rally?
Rally.
Yes. Yeah. Rally.
Design.
The Stratos Zero concept.
Stratos.
Stratos. That crazy, almost like low res wedge car from the 70s
cool.
That is like very small.
Yes.
And then, yeah, I did. You know, I saw that we were doing this episode. I pretend like I don't edit them. This came up on the calendar and I was like, you know what? I haven't seen a new Lancia in forever, but I know that they're still a company.
There's a reason why.
And the Ypsilon is just this blobby little economy commuter car. Not anything to write home about.
I remember we were either doing a, Up to Speed or a Wheelhouse on Lancia back in the day. And yeah, I remember finding that Ypsilon.
It was Up to Speed.
It was Up to Speed. Yeah, and finding that Ypsilon website and being very disappointed.
Everybody was bummed. It was a very sad day.
Yeah.
Everyone had boners that day. And then we all looked at that website and they all went down.
The boners went down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a huge HR.
They liked that they went down.
Yeah.
But they didn't like that we
then
had
they
them
were
in
like,
the
wait a minute,
place.
They were all up? And we're like, why did we bring this? Why did we tell them?
Yeah.
There was the Stratos concept that
the
was
Zero.
Gonna be. Yeah.
That's the one. There was a real Stratos
production
version. But the one that you're thinking of is the Stratos Zero concept.
Right.
And that's, I think, the most iconic.
No, I'm talking about, there was a company that tried to relaunch the Stratos brand.
That's right.
Oh, as a brand?
Yes.
Whoa.
Well, it was
very reminiscent of the original Lancia Stratos.
New Lancia Stratos.
Lancia.
Lancia. Yes. I can't even do it. This was years ago.
Yeah.
Manifatturi Automobili Torino. So they have their new Stratos, a racing classic reinvented. This is what their website says.
I just put it together
like 8 years ago, right?
Torino is Turin in Italian. God, I'm dumb sometimes.
Hey, me too. I didn't know that. But it is not a Lancia. It is an independent company that are making something that looks like Stratos.
It's like when people take it upon themselves to make donut stickers, and you're like, that's cool. Like, we also make those.
We do. All right. So should we get into the story?
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right.
We'll hear all about it.
Vincenzo Lancia.
Owners up.
Vincenzo Lancia was born in 1881 in the small village of Fobello, Italy, near Turin. His father was a wealthy soup manufacturer.
Did you say suit or soup?
Soup with a P.
Okay.
So we're talking minestrone, Tuscan kale and bean.
Why does it say manufacturer? Who manufactures soup? You cook it.
Is that maybe he's putting it in cans or something?
All right.
Yeah.
So yeah, his soup daddy made his money in Argentina before returning to Italy. When he was 18, Vincenzo began an apprenticeship with Giovanni Serrano, a bicycle importer in Turin. Serrano became part of Fiat in 1900, and Vincenzo was promoted to Fiat's chief inspector at the ripe old age of 19.
There's always that cross, not always, but that crossover between bicycle manufacturers becoming automobiles.
It always happens.
Peugeot.
Can you imagine entrusting a 19-year-old with, like, chief inspector role?
Yeah, well, people only live till about 40.
So he was, like, so elder at that point.
Yeah, middle-aged. So Vincenzo's role with Fiat involved test driving, and Vincenzo's skill behind the wheel impressed his bosses, who invited him to drive their cars in races. He entered Fiat's second race ever in 1906, the very first French Grand Prix at Le Mans. It was very different from what we think of Le Mans nowadays. The circuit went 64 miles through neighboring towns and ended back in the town of Le Mans. Drivers were to compete 6 laps per day for 2 days. Vincenzo got off to a great start and led the first lap with a time of just over 53 minutes.
So more than 60 miles per hour average.
So he's
on probably the worst roads.
Cobbles.
Yeah.
The unpaved roads kicked up so much dust that Vincenzo and other drivers were suffering eye problems. On the second day of the race, Lancia's co-driver could not be found, so Lancia had to jump in the Fiat in his street clothes. Despite the valiant effort, the car had to retire due to mechanical issues. Lancia knew there was room for improvement, so he and his colleague, Claudio...
Wait, did you look at me for mechanical issues because I'm a robot and I'm always spewing oil everywhere?
I got to grease your elbows later. I just remembered that. Lancia knew there was room for improvement. So he and his colleague, Claudio Fogolan, left Fiat to start their own factory with a focus on building race cars. However, things got off to a terrible start when a fire devastated the factory and destroyed their prototype chassis, delaying production. Eventually, the first prototype debuted at the 1908 Turin Motor Show, the Lancia Alpha.
Like, you don't know if it's like a fire truck or like a race car.
Yeah. It had a 2.5-liter side-valve four-cylinder engine with a power output of 28 horsepower and was notable for its innovative engineering, along with the first conventional all-coil spring suspension.
I feel like that's cool. And also, it's very analogous to like a 2.5-liter four-cylinder is very reasonable to have nowadays.
Although I'm looking at this one and this looks like it has leaf springs.
It's still a spring.
Maybe a version of it had
maybe
coil springs.
Maybe.
Also 28 horsepower from a four-cylinder in the like 1910s is pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah, it is. Over 100 of these Alphas were sold and most of them were raced. Here's a little side note. The Alpha was originally named the 12 horsepower or 12 HP, which was the standard naming system used in Europe at the time that adhered to the tax horsepower rating, which placed higher taxes on higher horsepowered cars, similar to how Japan operates nowadays. In 1919, Lancia retroactively renamed their cars to Greek letters. There you go.
It's also funny that they're like...
You said it was 28 horsepower, right?
That's so
they called
it
the 12 HP.
Yeah.
It's pretty sneaky, sis.
They're doing exactly what the gentleman's agreement did.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. The second car to come off the Lancia production line was the Epsilon. This car came in 5 different wheelbases for different applications like limousine, torpedoes, coupes, and landaulets. Lancia upped the displacement of their new monoblock four-cylinder to 4 liters, which could produce 60 horsepower at just 1,500 RPM.
Yeah.
1,500 RPM?
Yeah.
Well, so what did it idle at? 25?
Maybe. Which was not shabby for the era. 60 horsepower at 1,500 RPM?
That's great for that time period.
Yeah. One thing we would find strange about this car is that it didn't have front brakes. It had rear brakes and a brake built into the transmission, which was very common at the time. This car sold better than the Alfa, but the next car the company developed would be their first big hit.
Wait, so is that like a Jake brake?
A Jake brake is an exhaust brake.
Okay. Do your best Jake brake impression.
Okay.
Oh, God. You something. Spit all over.
Yeah. My mic. Yeah. I can spit all over it.
Yeah.
Pretty good. I feel like we all got a shade of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You put all those together.
Yeah. Put those all together, editor. Launch's first commercially successful car was the Theta. Produced from 1913 to 1919, the Theta was based on the Epsilon and had a 5-liter side-valve straight four, double the displacement of the Alfa's engine. With plenty of power on tap, it was popular among limousine drivers.
You picture the cylinders. That's bigger than a liter.
1.25 liters per cylinder.
Jeez, they're huge.
Yeah. The electrical side included a starter. You had headlights, taillights, a horn, and instrument lights that were powered by a 6-volt battery, a first for European cars at the time. 1,700 Thetas were produced in their 6-year run. That sounds like a nice car. Following the Theta came the Lambda, which was produced from 1922 to 1931. Up until this point, cars were all body-on-frame construction, meaning the chassis was built, then most commonly sent to a coach builder who would construct the body, which was then married to the frame. The Lambda was the first car to feature a monocoque chassis, making it stronger, more rigid, quieter, and smoother. And this type of construction wouldn't be seen until decades later when Lotus made the first monocoque race car in 1962, which wouldn't become commonplace in production cars until years after that. But the Theta's chassis wasn't the only innovative characteristic. The engine's groundbreaking V4 arrangement was compact enough that the gearbox could be mounted beneath the hood, which made it a significant departure from the more common inline configurations of the time. By 1925, less than 20 years after its founding, Lancia had made a dozen different cars and helped the industry as a whole progress from a primitive technology to a more viable means of transportation. In the 1930s, Lancia continued to grow in stature, much like myself. After the success the Lambda saw with high-end customers, the company began to focus more on luxury vehicles.
Did no one just plug himself?
No. I was like talking about stature. My stature. I'm talking about my
I thought,
spare tire.
I thought your like Instagram stature.
No, that's actually shrinking. Somehow. No, we had that. We put out that video the other day.
Yeah.
Like the 5-year retrospective on our Nissan Zs, and we were like playing like old clips from 2018.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, put on a few pounds.
It's all muscle. It's all neck muscle.
It's all face and neck muscle. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, from talking so much on camera, you're bound to get huge face muscles. Yeah.
It's really fun. It's really good. So this era saw the introduction of models like the Lancia Astura and Lancia Aprilia, which were renowned for their elegance and performance. The brand became a favorite among European aristocrats and celebrities.
And they very much are. When you look at these cars, they've got those big front fenders over the front wheels, the swooping lines.
Oh, like, yeah.
They look what you would picture a 30s Ford, you know.
For sure. Very
luxury, in quotes, luxury, top hat, tails. You're coming out of one of these.
Yeah, you're going from the opera to the Cheesecake Factory in one of these.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Whatever the 30s equivalent was of a Cheesecake Factory.
In Austria.
Yeah. Don't run into Gavrilo Princip when you're driving one of these.
Ooh, nice pull, dude.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Aprilia production saw another industry first for the company, the use of a wind tunnel. With the help of Battista Pininfarina and the Polytechnic Institute of Turin, Lancia designed the Aprilia to have an industry record low drag coefficient of 0.47. Another Italian design legend.
Put that into context for us.
I believe the new Prius, I think, has a drag coefficient of 0.28 or 0.29.
The most aerodynamic car on the road today is, I think, the Model S, and it's 0.022 or 0.023 drag efficient. So it's not too bad for the time. And I think the Jeep Wrangler has one of 0.67 or something like that. There's like lobsters are more aerodynamic than the Jeep Wrangler.
That's so true.
Like the VHS copy of The Lobster.
Another Italian design legend, Ugo Zagato, designed a special version of this car in 1938. We've talked about him before.
Yeah, Zagato was a design house. I think they did a couple Ferraris. They did the Porsche that I just saw at the Air Water thing, the 356 Coupe.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Lancia as a company had seen significant growth and prosperity, but disaster struck in 1937 when Vincenzo suddenly died of a heart attack. This was the first moment of crisis at Lancia.
How old was that's? Did I think I got his age right?
1937. He was born in 1881.
He wasn't even
56.
Oh, yeah, 56.
Yeah.
What did you say?
I said 40. By 40, you're done.
You're close.
Anyways,
56.
Younger than you would hope to live now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So this was the first moment of crisis at Lancia. Vincenzo's son Gianni was too young to take over.
Wasn't yet 19. Is that what you're telling me?
But the company managed to rally behind Vincenzo's widow and Gianni's mother, Adele Miglietti Lancia. This made Adele the first female CEO in the auto industry, the only female CEO until Mary Barra took over GM in 2014. She comfortably stepped into the role and would lead the company through the turmoil of World War II. During WW2, Lancia's production shifted towards manufacturing trucks and equipment for the Italian military. As a cog in Mussolini's war machine, this was a dark spot in Lancia's history. Fortunately for the world, the Axis powers lost. Many European automotive factories who were supporting the war effort were bombed by Allied powers, and Lancia suffered the same fate as companies like Fiat and Ferrari. Their factories in Turin were bombed in the early 1940s. The headquarters were temporarily relocated to Padua. In 1947, 23-year-old Gianni Lancia graduated from engineering school and took over for his mother as CEO. This was a mixed blessing for the company. Competitors like Alfa Romeo and Fiat received American economic aid through the Marshall Plan, which was intended to help rebuild Western Europe. However, Gianni and his wife were suspected of being communist sympathizers, so they didn't get any funding. 10 years after Vincenzo's death, Lancia once again found itself on the brink of insolvency. Two major factors helped the company bounce back: a general post-war economic boom and the successful recruitment of Alfa Romeo's chief engineer, Vittorio Giano. Gianni brought Giano in to ensure that his father's emphasis on engineering would continue, and the move immediately paid off. In 1948, Lancia fit the first 5-speed gearbox into a production car.
You see the 4-speed. What about the 5-speed?
Lancia's next big hit, the Aurelia, launched in 1950 at the Turin Motor Show. It was perhaps the most sophisticated automobile ever built to that point. It had unibody construction, independent suspension all around, and the first production
lithium-ion battery engine.
I was going to say the first full production V6 engine.
Oh, and a ball cooler.
Ball chiller. It also introduced the front engine rear transmission configuration later used by Ferrari, Porsche, and Maserati, among others. That's very interesting, too. Cool.
They don't get their roses on a lot of these
innovations,
but they did a lot.
They did. So the Aurelia was produced between 1950 and 1957, and although the V6 overall design remained largely the same, Lancia's engineer made near constant detail improvements to camshafts, heads, crankshafts, and blocks. And as a result, early 54 horsepower engines were soon supplanted by a bigger version that could provide up to 90 horsepower and soon became the darling of the Italian carrozzerie.
Dude, it sucks you can't find good Lancia Aurelias on Craigslist anymore.
Yeah, it's cars, cash for clunkers really sucked them all up.
Yeah, they're all clapped out now.
Yep.
Big wings.
They've all got fart cans on them and Timu racing seats and shift knobs. Yeah, it's tough. That is, threw it all away, all that stuff. In the early 50s, Gianni Lancia decided to organize a motorsports team and saw sports car racing as a good entry point. He launched the Scuderia Lancia Racing Workshop, which later became the Squadra Corsa HF Lancia.
Dude, Squadra is a sick name.
Yeah, it's dope.
HF.
We're a bit of a squadra ourselves, right?
Yeah, I think so. HF standing for high fidelity. A quick series of victories followed. Three straight in the Targa Florio between 52 and 54. A podium sweep led by Juan Manuel Fangio in the 1953 Carrera Panamericana, and another win in the 1954 Mille Miglia. This success inspired Lancia to make the jump into F1 with a car called the D50. The D50 made its debut towards the end of the 1954 F1 season in the hands of two-time world champ Alberto Ascari. Early signs were promising, as Ascari finished ahead of, among others, Mercedes-Benz. Then suddenly, tragedy struck again when Ascari was killed while practicing in a Ferrari near Milan.
We talked about that in the Phil Hill episode.
You're like an encyclopedia of our episodes. I never remember what we talk about. But then I Googled this car, the Lancia D50.
That's so sick. Classic. That's what I thought.
Well, it's also,
when you said torpedo, that's what I thought of that. But I don't know what the specific type of body that's called.
It's also, it's open wheel.
Open wheel tube.
They weren't, not every company was doing like that car. The body of it goes out to where the wheels are, thus reducing drag.
This is one of the coolest cars I think I've ever seen.
It's so sick.
I love it. Wow.
That's the thing is like, for 100 years, made the sickest cars, like in every type of motorsport, too.
I want to drive one of these old style Grand Prix cars so bad. Yeah. This is so, we gotta get this is probably Goodwood. $50 million for this thing, but like,
but Jared drove that Jaguar that was $50 million.
That's true.
Steve McQueen's. I think I'm going to pitch this as an idea for the main channel, getting you to drive in the Goodwood.
That'd be sick.
That circuit of like the vintage cars, and get you in an open wheel racer like this.
I would love to.
And
drive
just one. Like, get you generational debt as you crash it into the tires.
Thanks so much. I would love that. So, Gianni was hurt by the loss of Ascari, burned out by leading both the company and team, and saw the cost of F1 taking a toll on Lancia. He decided to pull out of F1 mid-season. However, rather than seeing a D50 go to waste, he decided to give his six completed cars and a truckload of parts to his competitors over at Ferrari, along with his head engineer, Vittorio Giano. Ferrari and Fangio used a simplified version of Giano's design called the Ferrari D50 to win the 1956 World Championship.
They didn't even change the name.
No. During their competition lifespan, these D50s were entered into 14 Formula One Grand Prix, winning five of them.
Damn, they had a gem on their hands and they just let it go.
In the mid-1950s, the Lancia name was held in high regard by Italian consumers and even respected by competitors like Ferrari and Alfa Romeo. But Lancia was already falling behind their compatriots. Vincenzo's original ethos of quality and envelope-pushing engineering meant every car was manufactured by hand. With little commonality between the various models, the cost of production continued to rise. Meanwhile, competitors were reducing costs by using modern, mass-production methods. Lancia sales flatlined in the mid-50s, and in mid-1956, Gianni was forced to sell the family company to businessman Carlo Pezzenti.
Always a good move.
Pezzenti's my favorite thing to order from Pizza Hut. It's like a pizza tube.
By then, the Aurelia had been retired and was replaced by the less groundbreaking, but ideally more profitable, Flaminia. As one of his final acts in charge, Gianni brought in a new engineer named Antonio Fessia to replace Giano. Fessia had previously worked at Fiat, and Pezzenti, who made his money in the cement industry and perhaps didn't know the nuance of car manufacturing, was happy to let Fessia run the show at Lancia. Pezzenti also decided to build a completely new factory in Chivasso, on the outskirts of Turin, which would bring Lancia's production capacity from 70 cars per day up to 300 when the plant opened.
Nolan, I just want to commend you on all your pronunciation today.
Thank you.
A lot of different words.
Thank you. Can't wait to mess up the next one. The factory opening in 1963 coincided with the launch of the two-door Fulvia.
It's a great car.
Great name.
That's like a cult classic.
This car was notable for its FF layout, front-engine, front-wheel drive car, a first for Lancia. Pezzenti spent a huge amount of time racing the Fulvia, and like its Lancia predecessors, it became a favorite among rally enthusiasts. But this strategy again proved to be a drain on the company's stretched financial resources. Mazzenti was caught between a rock and a hard place. His new factory in Chivasso had cost a ton, but it wasn't running yet at full capacity. Lancias were being made and bought, but competition in the luxury car sector was becoming cutthroat thanks to a new foreign competitor, Germany. In the 60s, both BMW and Mercedes invested in new production techniques that brought down their costs dramatically without sacrificing quality. Around the same time, VW resurrected the upmarket Audi brand, which targeted the same customers. By focusing on motorsports rather than improving Lancia's output, Pezzenti made essentially the same exact mistake as Gianni Lancia. Consequences were similar as well. In 1969, with his company trapped in a downward spiral, Pezzenti approached Gianni Agnelli, head of Fiat, with a proposal. Pezzenti and Agnelli made a deal for Fiat to step in and invest in Lancia in mid-1969. Fiat paid 1 Italian lira for each piece of Lancia stock, taking over company operations and debt. Today's auto industry has practically been merged to death, but this particular merger saved Lancia from an untimely demise. But was it a good investment on Fiat's behalf? The company was hemorrhaging money, losing 20 million Italian lira in 1969 alone. Nevertheless, some purists insist that a post-1969 Lancia isn't a Lancia at all. In part because of quality issues with Fiat-built Lancias. The Beta, Fiat's first new Lancia model, became the best-selling car in the history of the badge, then quickly became an embarrassment as it suffered from the same rust problems as other Fiats of the era, despite a higher price tag.
That's a bummer.
Woof.
Should have opted for the rust protection.
However, the Beta race cars that competed did very well. Instead of rally, Lancia focused on making the Beta reliable for endurance racing. Lancia enlisted the help of some of the most prolific figures in Italian motorsport, including Abarth, Pininfarina, and Dallara. Giampaolo Dallara reworked the factory monocoque chassis to be more rigid and lightweight and upgraded the suspension. Pininfarina developed the striking aerodynamics, and Abarth took their 1.4-liter four-banger, strengthened the internals, and slapped a huge turbo on it, resulting in 490 horsepower at full boost, which is sent to the rear wheels. The Group 5 Lancia Beta Monte Carlo Turbo was born, and here is what it looks like. I
absolutely love this car. The market on Beta Monte Carlo Turbos is just all over the place right now. It's so crazy.
Can't even get these for 20 grand anymore, dude.
No. We used to give these away at AutoZone.
So the Beta Monte Carlo Turbo handily won in Group 5, taking home top prize in the sub 2-liter category for the World Championship for makes in 1979 and an overall win in 1980. Then it won the World Endurance Championship for makes in 1981. The Beta was winning on track, but on the consumer side, the reliability scandal severely damaged Lancia's international reputation.
The reliability was about rust problems.
Yes. Sales in Scandinavia, Germany, and England plummeted. It was even rumored that Fiat had used cheap Soviet steel, although these claims have never been verified, and the problem was more likely due to poor assembly in the first place. However, the company was doing deals behind the Iron Curtain at the time with companies like Lada and Yugo. Despite the rust problems under the Fiat, other Lancia fans consider this to be the best era in the brand's history, thanks to the arrival of one particular model, the aforementioned and legendary Stratos. This futuristic wedge-shaped success story began at the 1970 Turin show with a futuristic concept by Marcello Gandini, chief designer at Bertone, called the Stratos Zero.
That guy comes up a lot.
Sure does.
Gandini?
It was one of the most striking and iconic concept cars of the time. It had a cockpit that was accessed via a flip-up windshield and a retractable steering wheel for easier entry. The digital dashboard was extremely innovative for the time as well. And sitting at just 33 inches tall, this concept was more reminiscent of a George Barris custom than the work of a major car brand. The production version design of the Lancia Stratos was tamed down just a little bit, but still maintained
just a little bit,
the futuristic wedge shape. I mean, it's still crazy looking. Yeah. The Stratos was dubbed the world's first purpose-built rally car. It's one of the most distinctive and aerodynamic cars of its era, combining a compact mid-engine layout with a rear-mounted Ferrari Dino V6, sending 180 horsepower to the rear wheels.
That's cool. That's fun. That's a fun car.
Yeah.
I bet I couldn't fit in this car.
I
mean, the concept was 33 inches tall. You'd have to be stretched out, laying down.
Yeah. There are even crash helmet bins, quote unquote, built into the doors. Built as a homologation special per the World Rally Championship, Launcher was on the hook to build at least 500 of these things. After entering production in 1973, the Stratos won the World Rally Championship 3 years in a row. It also won the Tour de France Automobile 5 times and the rally that started it all for Lancia, the Targa Florio.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
The Stratos was capable enough as a racer that it was still winning major international events up until 1981. Production cars petered out in 1975 after 492 cars were built, many of them plagued with reliability issues. Another legendary car made its debut around this time, the Lancia Rally, otherwise known as the 037.
I did not know that was the proper name.
I had no idea either.
Yeah.
Named after the project number, the 037 started development in 1980 to comply with new Group B regulations. Now, instead of having to make 500 homologated versions, they only need to produce 200 road cars. I love the 037. I think it's way cooler than the Stratos. Maybe not way cooler, but I like it more.
I think it's more up my
alley.
It's
less of a unicorn, right? It looks more like, if you're thinking of a rally car,
yeah,
it feels like.
I want to ever see that.
The Stratos was kind of like, yeah, it wins, but it looks a little bit different.
Yeah.
I still like the Stratos.
I think
the Stratos is cool. I want to rescind my statement. I don't think it's way cooler than the Stratos, but I like this a lot more.
I really like the Delta or the 037 were my favorite launches up until reading this story. And then I think the Beta Monte Carlo Turbo.
That thing is sick as hell.
Has unseated all those.
Yeah. Anyway, the 037 was built on the framework of the Beta Monte Carlo. A Barth, now fully part of the Fiat family, took lead on the design. They used design elements from rally cars of the 50s and 60s, including the double bubble roofline. Echoing the development of the Beta Monte Carlo, Pininfarina and Dallara were also tapped for the design. Having just employed a V6 in the Stratos, a Barth opted for a lighter, supercharged inline 4, this time making around 325 horsepower.
I want to hear this car. I've heard it in the past, but never heard it just rev by itself.
Yeah. The 037 saw some amazing rally wins, including the 1982 WRC Manufacturers Championship. But in the end, there was no beating the all-wheel drive systems. There's a whole episode on Lancia versus Audi in Group B that we did. So if you'd like to hear more about Lancia's rally cars, listen to Past Gas episode 88. We did that a while ago.
Yeah. Audi really destroyed rally for a long time in Group B.
Yeah. It helps to be able to put the power
all
down
four
through
wheels.
All 4 wheels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Neither the 037 nor the Stratos could save Lancia with rally wins. The company still needed to sell road cars to make money, cars that were literally rusting away. In the UK, Lancia was forced to buy back over 1,000 Betas after it was discovered that their front subframe mounts had rotted away, allowing the engine to drop by 3 inches.
That's not a big deal.
That's pretty big.
Go for it.
A subsequent six.
You're like, oh, wait, how much did it drop by? And you're like, zip.
A subsequent 6-year, quote, corrosion prevention warranty failed to instill confidence in consumers. The whole episode was a PR and financial disaster for Lancia.
It's crazy how that can just ruin a company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just you earn that reputation and you can't get rid of it.
Well, it's such a big purchase that you're like, I'm not willing to stake
right.
my life.
Well, it's
savings.
The opposite of what happened with Hyundai, where they offered the 100,000.
Yeah.
It was like, if that's what you're offering, and then they held up.
Oh, I just could do them.
This was a huge disaster in the home of its largest customer base outside Italy. In fact, Lancia's next car, the Delta, would prove to be the company's last model ever sold in the UK. Initially, the Delta was nothing more than a boring family hatchback, made no technological breakthroughs, and wasn't considered fast by the standards of the era. It was also a Lancia in name only, since the Fiat Ritmo and the Lancia Delta were twins with different badges. However, after poor rally seasons in 1984 and 85, Lancia realized they needed to start from scratch with a car that would serve its drivers better. Thus, the Delta S4 was born, combining a twin-charged 483-horsepower engine with all-wheel drive for incredible power and traction. Martini-liveried versions of this car dominated the World Rally Championship during the late 80s and early 90s.
I love this car.
Mm-hmm.
We saw one outside
and
of our old...
And that livery, not for nothing.
Oh, the livery.
That Martini Rossi livery.
I love that livery. we saw one, we saw, you know, a road-going version outside of our office at our old place.
Mm.
And there was that garage that was like a block away that always had supercars and stuff.
Yeah.
I remember the guy was just like sitting in it on his phone and we're like, oh, grab a camera. Let's go. You know, like, I don't know what we were trying to do with it, but the guy wanted nothing to do with us.
Yeah, he pulled a gun. I remember that day.
Yeah. He said, I'm going to shoot myself if you don't run away.
WRC rules required 5,000 production units to be produced in order to compete in the series, which gave rise to the Delta HF Integrale road car. Eventually, more than 44,000 of these cars were built. This Delta continues to enjoy a cult following among classic car and rally enthusiasts.
I wonder if that's where the Audi 5000 name comes from.
No, isn't there an Audi 5000?
Yes. But if they were also homologating, because it's like, what is, it's not a 5 liter. It's not a.
Yeah, you might be right.
It's if there only there was like a.
Way to look things up on a database.
A compendium of information. We'll just never know. Bilancia was thrown another twist in 1986 when Fiat acquired Alfa Romeo. Resuscitating Lancia's direct competitor suddenly became Fiat's top priority. Alfa and Lancia were paired together within the Fiat group, but it was clear which badge took priority by the huge resources Fiat dedicated towards Milan.
It's this, like the Macaulay Culkin Elijah Wood movie? The Good Son?
Why did you bring that up?
Because the mom adopts this new son.
I see.
And he's the problem child.
That's right.
And he's gaslighting the other kid.
Right.
And then before you know it,
he's dropping bricks on cars.
Yeah. Before you know it, the mom's holding both of them over the cliff, mm-hmm. but she can only save one.
Sophie's Choice.
Is that what the movie is?
Is it a good movie?
I remember it being pretty good. Macaulay Culkin plays a little crazy dude.
Yeah. Like,
he's really good at whatever, you know, a little narcissist.
Mm-hmm. And Elijah Wood is remarkably good at like having his eyes wide open and looking really innocent and freaked out the whole time.
I should watch that. This whole Good Son situation essentially meant the end of Lancia as a fire-breathing, adrenaline-juicing, high-performance rally car brand. By 1991, the Delta HF Integrale held 5 WRC titles under its belt, yet Lancia retired from rallying.
That's dumb, dude.
In 1993, Fiat closed the Chivasso plant, switching production to Fiat and Alfa facilities and exacerbating quality control issues.
Ugh.
In 1990, Lancia was still selling 300,000 cars a year. That's pretty good.
Yeah. That is really good.
But by 2010, that number had plummeted to less than 100,000. So what the heck happened? Well, it's hard to succeed when you don't know what you are. Was Lancia a maker of quirky everyday cars? A builder of heavy-duty sports machines? A purveyor of luxury vehicles, perhaps? The answer was...
Some other cinnamon for seller and car?
The answer was all of the above and none of the above. After bowing out of rally in the early 90s, Lancia pivoted towards luxury yet again, but the results were mixed. The Thesis, a blobby full-size luxury car, barely made a blip before disappearing in 2009. Here's a picture of it.
It's so gross.
It's definitely ugly.
That's bad.
I kind of like it, though.
No.
I kind of do.
Luckily, the market on those is pretty good.
Yeah, I could probably find
one. It's like a Pixar character that has really small eyes.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like the Shrew from... Ice Age or something?
Well, that's not Pixar.
Oh, DreamWorks.
Yeah. Come on, Joe.
Not even DreamWorks.
Come on, Joe.
The eyes are very small on the face of this car is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. The third gen Lancia Delta was essentially a dressed up Fiat Bravo and the company's last attempt at a flagship luxury car. For a while, Lancia was a zombie brand shambling through the Italian market, slapping its badge on rebranded Chryslers. And by 2014, Lancia had been paired back to a single model, the Ypsilon, another Fiat Bravo clone sold exclusively in Italy. Then, came Stellantis. In 2021, a merger between Fiat Chrysler and France's PSA Group brought new hope to Lancia fans. Lancia quickly announced bold plans to relaunch as an electric vehicle brand with three new EVs slated between 2024 and 2028, a new Ypsilon, a new Delta, and a mysterious third model. The first step in the plan arrived in February of 24 with the launch of the fourth generation Ypsilon, available in electric and hybrid versions. We talked about this at the top of the show. Building on this momentum, Lancia announced the revival of its legendary HF performance division, unveiling an all-new Ypsilon HF, set to launch in 2025 alongside a Rally 4 variant that marks Lancia's return to rally championships. In October of 2024, Stellantis doubled down on its commitment to Italy, announcing that despite industry challenges, the upcoming Lancia Gamma, a mid-sized crossover, would be built at its Melfi plant starting in 2026.
The heritage of Lancia wrapped up in the skin of a Toyota CHR.
Well, it's probably a Dodge Hornet.
Yeah, a Dodge Hornet.
With a Lancia badge on it.
Which is also an Alfa Romeo.
Yes. Stelvio?
No. What is it? It's got a different kooky name.
Just Tonale. Tonale. Toenail.
Toenail.
Yeah, that's right. Lancia's journey has been nothing short of a roller coaster, from trailblazing engineering and rally dominance into multiple death spirals and back again. Few brands have experienced such dramatic highs and lows. Yet, through it all, Lancia has retained a unique place in automotive history, a name synonymous with bold innovation, breathtaking design, and occasional rusty holes. Whether its electric future will rekindle the brilliance of its past remains to be seen, but if history is any guide, Lancia might not be done surprising the world just yet.
That's an optimistic view, but
maybe a little too optimistic.
There's two ways brands and nameplates get brought up again, and it's through crossovers and EV stuff. That's just like the easy way to
bring a crown,
bring a brand back.
It's a little lazy.
It's never cool. I'd say once in a while, it's kind of cool.
I love the 037. I love the Group 5 Monte Carlo Beta. Is that what it's called? Beta Turbo Monte Carlo.
Beta Monte Carlo Turbo.
Yeah. That's my new favorite car. It's the coolest car ever. The D50.
I have one in my driveway. It's not running, but.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get it there. All right, that is our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Big thank you to our crew. Edgar standing right behind the camera over there, and Audrey behind the mixing board.
And our writer this week, Greg Nix, always delivers.
Crushing it. Make sure you check out The Big Three. It's our current event news show. It's a lot of fun. And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.